You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Like, 8:36 here on a Monday. On a Wednesday morning, All Marine Radio, we continue. Joining me is the man who Dave Furness was snatching the pebbles out of at the basic school as an instructor in about 1989 or 90. Mike Pesnola joins us. He is currently the executive director at the Institute for Global Leadership at Tufts University. Pez, first of all, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, and thank you for having me. This is an honor. It's really great to be here. Great to be here. Great to talk and reminisce about great things. Good to be here.
I want to tell you that there's a picture of you that I see when I was looking you up. It's a picture of you and your dad, and you're in your dress blues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an awesome picture. Tell me, you grew up in Massachusetts. What did your dad do for a living?
Yeah, I grew up in Brockton, Mass, and my dad was an electrical contractor, but he's really why, you know, went to the Marine Corps. He was in the Navy, but he was just 4 years in the Navy on the Saratoga, and he always talked so fondly of that experience and about it, you know, just being a great experience, service, and so forth. So he was really the reason that I was energized to pursue a career in the service. And and that picture, I could never get my mom and pop to a Marine Corps ball. It didn't work out. But it was a few years ago, and it was here at the Semper Fi Society lunch, mm-hmm. which is done every year, and he just had a blast. He was so proud of just being able to participate in something like that. So,
well, it's a great picture, and I always say the best pictures I've ever taken in my life I've taken with my kids, and mm-hmm. because. For whatever reason, love tends to seep into your smile, and it's no effort at all to smile when you're right. And that certainly comes out of that picture. Obviously, he's certainly really proud of you, and the affection that comes through in that picture is awesome. I saw it there. I thought it was very cool. So you're growing up in Massachusetts. You go to college where?
University of Lowell. Now UMass Lowell.
And
great hockey school.
You're a hockey player.
Yeah.
So you're a tough guy.
I'm a goalie.
No. You're saying you
puck shot it.
Well, maybe arguably the toughest guy on the ice. So you're rolling around. Your dad's in the Navy. And why the Marine Corps? How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, I was one of my buds at school. He went to a thing called PLC, Platoon Leads Course, summer of like 80. And Jim McBarris, he came back and told me about it. And I, like I said, with my dad, I'd always wanted to go in the service. Didn't get selected from the academies or whatever. And went and talked to a recruiter, and summer of 81, went down and to PLC Junior up at Camp Upshur. And never turned back. I mean, I loved it. I mean, it was hard, and that's what I liked about it. It was challenging. But for me, it was, hey, I like this. This is the career I want. And I signed right up, you know, and went again in 83. And interestingly, Jim McBarris, the guy who got me in, 25 years later, I was I up in 125, and who was in the battalion as a reserve, Lieutenant Colonel Jim McBarris. It's a small world, man.
Exactly. So be careful the way you treat people.
Absolutely.
I give advice to single moms, when asked, and it's not too often, but this is the advice I give. Is it good for my son to play sports? You know, his dad's not around. And I said, yes. And the sport you need to get him into is ice hockey. And they look at me, they're like, why ice hockey? It's like, I said, because it teaches toughness, and you hear stuff yelled off a hockey bench that you don't hear yelled at in any other bench now. It's a completely team-oriented sport. And it's a throwback sport in terms there's still a lot of tradition to it, but there's a toughness in it that's good for boys to grow up with and sticking up for your teammates and all that kind of stuff. And it'll be good for your boy. You know, both my sons played, I played, but I didn't start playing until later in life. Give me your thoughts about that, Pez. I think hockey is a great sport because boys now get raised to be half girl. You get in a fight at school, you get expelled, for God's sake.
Absolutely. And the one thing I'll add to that, it not only is it a tough sport, it's a team sport. But the toughness also breeds respect. You know, what do you do at the end of every game?
Shake
hands. You line up and shake hands. I mean, that doesn't happen enough. It happens in some other sports, but I'm with you. It's... you know, it's getting hit, hitting and getting hit and learning that. I mean, that's life, you know, and it teaches you that life lesson so you can, you know, kind of later some of the things we did in the Marine Corps, but so you can think while you're being hit. That all translates to combat. That all translates to life. You know, how do you deal with that, with chaos? How do you deal with, you know, with pain? You know, how do you think when all that stuff's happening? So, yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm a big believer in sports in general, but hockey is definitely one of the best ones to go into.
You know, it's interesting at the highest levels, hockey gives, I think, moments that the other sports don't have. They're trying to replicate hockey. One is the Stanley Cup trophy presentation. Now everybody's gone to presenting the trophy in public on a raised podium. Hockey has this natural moment that kids replay. All over they'll do it today playing, you know, boot hockey or road hockey or wherever they're playing, which is lifting the Stanley Cup. The captain of the team goes out, and there's this magical moment when he grabs a cup and he puts it over his head that is the coronation. And it's, I don't care how many times you've seen it. I don't care. Even if the team that won you hate, you can't help but smile when you see it because it's just this quintessential great moment in team sports. The other moment I think that's equally as good that no other sport has, in my opinion, is shaking hands at the end of the series. You line up, and guys you've been brawling with, you shake hands, and you congratulate them. No other sport has that. Hockey has both those very classic moments that I think are awesome.
No, absolutely. And again, it's that respect. I mean, you know, hockey has fighting, but that's bred out of, that's part of the game. It's a tough game. It's part of the game, But again, they may fight one day. They may be pulling the shirt over their head, but there's a respect there, and so that's a lesson. And the Stanley Cup. What in the history that thing has. I mean, no other sport not only has that, but I mean, think, you know, the team owns it for a year, and they bring it around, and they do all kind of crazy things with it. So it has a history. I mean,
write
a book on this.
And my name's on the thing.
Life. Yeah. You get your name emblazoned on. That's awesome.
Like, all the rest of you could tell me that I'm an idiot, but I know one thing. My name's on that cup, and exactly nobody can. What, Pesta, you joined the Marine Corps. I got an email question first. Mac, I'm interesting. I'm laughing. How did he become a goaltender, for God's sakes? That doesn't sound like a very fun, position to play. Is it a fun position to play? How'd you become a goalie, for God's sake?
It was awesome. Well, I started really young, and I wasn't, you know, when I like first started skating, wasn't the best skater. So normally what happens is they put you in goal, but I was you know, I put the stuff on and never took it off. And I liked it. It, again, it was a challenge, and But I was pretty good, so I got selected for the All-Star teams and, you know, the Pee Wee and this and that, got to travel around. And it was really fun. Getting pucks shot at you. You got a mask on. You got health equipment. Sometimes you get bruised up. But it's at the center of the action pretty much. So it's, it was kind of like joining the Marine Corps. Why do you do it? Hey, I enjoyed it. And I enjoy playing goalie.
Goalie, wow! You know the guys I know that play that position love it, and they, you know, it's like, hey, look, first of all, I'm the only guy who's on the ice the whole time, and you know, you're a lot more part of it in terms of you're really coaching on the ice, helping out the defensemen, calling out plays, you know, yelling things at you know, guys that are open and things like that you can't see on TV. That makes the position extremely intense and a lot of fun to play.
And I think, you know, again, looking back, I think it taught me to handle pressure because, again, when you're playing on travel teams, this and that, a lot of pressure's on the goalie. I mean, especially if you, you know, give up a light goal or whatever. It's kind of like a pitcher in baseball, I guess. But so you learn to handle that pressure and you just internalize that. And you learn to operate, you know,
under pressure.
And deal with it.
Now, when you gave up a goal, was your mom standing kind of near you yelling, "We love you, Michael. We love you, Michael. It's not your fault."
Yeah, that happens sometimes, I think.
Goalie parents are normally neurotic. Your dad doesn't look like a neurotic guy. Your dad looks come on, Michael, stop that the next time. But it's really funny as you having kids that grew up. And I will tell you, the thing I loved about watching my boys play hockey was when they would get drilled, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, one was a defenseman and a tough kid. The other one, a forward, who didn't like to get hit a whole lot. And wasn't as big as his older brother and was not afraid to, as soon as the referee took his eyes off him, to give the back of your calves the best shot you've ever had in his life. But I loved was, you get to see if they're, it makes you, it's a tough sport for tough guys. And then physical contact and even, you know, scuffling doesn't bother them. They're talking trash while they're doing it. And I think, for boys to be physically confident, and that breeds to toughness that translates in life because, you know, I go give a talk called, you know, what I call the keys of life when asked to younger people. And I talk about the keys of life: respect, hard work, discipline, and the other thing I add in there is toughness. And people look at me and they're like, "Wow!" I never expected. You know, my sister had her only two sons murdered by their father. Right? I never thought that would be involved in my life. My parents divorced and they never spoke to each other again. Annihilated our family. If you don't raise your kids to be tough, when life rolls on them, what do they do? How do they do it? And so to me,
absolutely,
hockey is a piece of that because it's a tough guy sport and it teaches physical toughness and mental toughness, as Mike said, handling winning and losing and all of that. And was your dad a hockey player or was it just something you grew up doing?
No, it was a neighborhood kind of thing. He played football. I think his brothers played hockey, but it was the sport in our neighborhood in the late 60s and go get some skates, go get some equipment, go out there, you know, all right, fine. And, you know, that was our family sport. You know, me and my brothers all play.
Mike Pesnola, Colonel Todd, United States Marine Corps retired, currently the executive director at the Institute for Global Leadership, Tufts University. How did you become a Marine Corps, an infantry officer?
Well, you know, when I went through PLC, I liked the platoon leader course. I liked being in the field. I liked that stuff. So when I went to the basic school, that's what I wanted to be. I mean, I never wanted to be anything else, you know, so, that's how it happened. And if you know how the whole MOS selection works, it's kind of crazy, but you know, I made it and went through IOC. I don't know if I could make it through IOC today, man. It's a tough course.
I don't think I could.
But yeah, I tell you. But didn't look back. That's what I wanted to do, and I loved every minute of it. It was it seemed like the leadership that I get and just doing the most of what I felt was the most important job in the Marine Corps. You know, everyone supports that infantryman, every Marine or rifleman, everyone supports that infantryman. So it just seemed, it was natural. That's what I wanted to do.
Right. You know, because I felt the same stuff in terms of, I watched my dad managing a Major League Baseball, and I didn't know anything about, I didn't know shit about the Marine Corps, right? So I'm working for Merrill Lynch, and I'm like, what do I want to do with my life? And nobody in my family is in the military. My dad was in for 2 years and played baseball. My uncle was in Germany, but I mean, I didn't have any, you know, I didn't know any Marines. I just had seen him in San Diego when I was down there when he was manager of the Padres, and I was completely impressed by him. And so I go into the recruiter's office, and he shows me a picture of an F-18. What would you think about flying one of these? I'm like, well, would you guys let me? They're like, yeah, you got to take the vision test, which means he had a flight contract open, and he had to fill it. So that's how he – and so I got to the basic school, and I had seen enough at both officer candidate school and at the basic school when I got there to know that what I was good at was coaching. And what made sense to me in my life was decision making with a lineup card in sports. And I knew how to do that. And I looked at what a platoon commander, an infantry platoon commander does. And I said, you know what? I know that. I know that job. I don't know how to do it this thing, but I know how to do conceptually it. I know how to handle people. I've watched it my whole life. That's what I want to do. So very similar kind of life experience in terms of growing up in sports and then looking at that job saying, you know what? That's what the Marine Corps is about. I know I can do that. I know I could be good at it. And same kind of experience. Tell me about a couple leaders in your Marine Corps career that had a huge impact on your path.
All right. Well, let's see. John Kelly. He was with us, obviously, at TBS, just retired from commander of Southern Command. He really... taught me the educational aspect of our profession. He had all those traits, you know, just a superior leader, caring, tough, but he also made you think, you know. So I had the opportunity to work with him at TBS, but also he was my commander at 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance. And just... He's one of the few guys that implemented a PME program and kept to it, you know, and inspired me for the rest of my career for a life of learning, a love of learning, of just reading, writing, and thinking, you know. So that's really what he gave me. In terms of that, he was central to that time at TBS and then that time at LAR. So John Kelly and then Bill McCraven, who I worked for in Special Operations Command, yeah. Another guy that just tremendous leader, would take time out to you know, eyeball, you know, conversations and just a tremendous role model. In some very difficult situations, but just calm under pressure and just a good friend. So yeah, I definitely say him. And then, you know, you had Bob Humphrey. I mean, he really had a great influence on me, just him and his dad, just some of the whole values piece, the things, you know, I listened to the talk last week and he and I have had that whole talk before, you know, and so it was.
Well, hold on. Let me stop you just to set this up.
Yeah.
Here's this connection that keeps winding its way through All Marine Radio. Mm-hmm. Jess Humphrey, Bob's little brother, and I crossed paths in with one MEF, and we're both working for the MEF. So I start doing this, and Jess gets interested in it. Because it's an intellectual family, although they don't come across like that. They come across as just good. They're good Midwestern people, right? That's the way they come across. Anyway, so Jess introduces me to a guy named Jack Hoban, and he said you need to have him on. He's written this book called The Ethical Warrior. So Jack Hoban comes on, and he says, look, I'm living my life. I'm doing martial arts. I come back. I go to school. I meet this guy named Robert Humphreys, who looks at me and says, you're a Marine. And I said, yeah, I am. And then I asked him, were you in the Marine Corps? Yeah, what'd you do? I was a platoon commander on Iwo Jima. He said, with that, I went silent. I knew that my speaking part was over. He said, but he was the most influential man in my life. And the things he taught me, I will never forget. I've taken them to, it's his teachings that really are the basis of the MCMAP program, that it's this concept of the ethical warrior. We've now exported that into the ethical guardian that we're teaching police officers to use, that he believes is the way of the future in terms of policing. It's being practiced right now in Camden, New Jersey, one of the most violent communities in the country. You know, blah, 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 blah. So now I'm listening to this going, and he uses this term that he's taken from Robert Humphrey's teachings, pre-zilience, which is this program dedicated to post-combat related mental health, pre-zilience, making you mentally aware of what's going to happen to you mentally. So when it happens to you, you're more inclined to put your hand up and say, hey, I need some help. And I thought, pre-zilience, what an awesome term, what an awesome concept, and where we need to go. Then Jess tells me, hey, you know, you should have my brother on. I said, okay.
Yeah.
So now he comes on. Now we're talking, and he starts talking about going to Turkey with his dad and the family he got raised in and the kind of things his dad taught him. But then, Pez, I'm sitting there thinking, I know him from someplace. And so he starts going through his tours, and he said, and then I was at the basic school at the time. He said, I was at AWS, and I said, that's where I know you from. Because this is just a dynamic. We had the whole maneuver warfare things going on, General Gray's commandant, John Schmitz writing FMFM1 at the time, and we have this. We don't know it at the time because we're just like shithead captains, lieutenants. Furness is a lieutenant, right? He's a punk, right? And, you know, he's had an article published in the Gazette as he comes, like, okay, who are you? And just shut up for a second, okay? But we have a whole bunch of guys like that, and they're tough, fun, smart, and they're writers. And they'll argue with you. And we used to do these Nash sessions, we'd call them. And somebody would write a paper, we'd hand it out, and then we'd rip the shit and argue about it. But it was this awesome intellectual experience. Amphibious Warfare School wouldn't participate with us. And we're trying to figure out maneuver warfare. But the one guy that would was a guy named Humphrey.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And after 20 odd years, I still remember that. Like, you were the guy that had the great reputation that you would talk and all of this. And so this Humphrey thing is like seeped into the wood of all Marine Radio. And then lo and behold, Pez is married to the sister. How do you meet her? And then tell me what it was like to meet your father-in-law and be around him. That had to be incredible.
Well, Melissa was staying with Bob's wife, her sister, down in Quantico, working at the flower shop. And my roommate was in Bob's seminar session, so blind date. We met, and the rest is history. And I had known, Bob, through the same thing. You know, Bob was just the one guy that we could talk to. And I don't know what the whole, you know, we theorized on the maneuver warfare piece that Gray wanted to spread it across the whole Marine Corps, tried in the schools. He saw us as the incubator to plant it with the lieutenants, with these crazy captains and lieutenants. Then it would go. And that AWS just wasn't, at the time, they weren't receptive to the changes we were doing and what we wanted to do, but Bob was that one guy. So that's how that all happened. And then met his dad a couple of times, and just amazing. But like I said, the talk that Bob gave you on the radio, we've had that discussion many times, and it's just, it influenced me in terms of, you know, of how you develop that ethical warrior, how putting putting the Marines in, you know, in pressure situation, whether it be in a boxing ring. But that, what that does is it teaches them to think under pressure. It teaches them to respect one another. If you read Values into the Next Millennium, his dad's book, that's what it's all about. It's about teaching these inner city kids who you know, start out as punks, but they become better people when you put them in the ring and they actually have to take a punch. They have to give and take a punch. They learn to respect one another. So, you know, that's, I'm oversimplifying it, but some fascinating stuff. But that's, you know, that's Bob. That's Bob and his family. And you got it right. They are an intellectual family, but tough family.
Yeah, he was. I interviewed his brother, the PFC, Cal Humphrey, and what an interesting, what a great interview. First of all, I mean, you know, PFC on Iwo Jima. I remember, I said, "What's the best advice that you ever got on Iwo Jima?" He said, "Don't be the first one out of the foxhole."
That's good. All right.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and no, just it's a great interview. And, you know, he talks about post-combat related mental health, and I want to ask you about that, Pez. But he talked about it, and he said, you know, and it was a different generation, you know, tremendously respectful of their own parents. And I would say they wouldn't want to talk to it, that stuff about their parents, out of respect. I don't want you to know what I've done. You know, the terrible things that I've done. And he said, look, you know, my son asked me at one point, why did I ever talk about it? And he said, what am I going to tell you or your mom that I, you know, or my mom that I didn't change my clothes for a month. I was filthy, that I had lice, that I, you know, I had to, you know, wipe my ass with my hand, that the volcanic sand on Iwo was good because you could get that stuff off easier off your hand because of that sand, that I watched, you know, one of my friends bleed to death in a foxhole, and the only thing I could do was give him a shot of morphine because, you know, there's nothing I could do for him. And the corpsman would have been stupid to come because he'd have got killed too. And he said, well, I mean, who would I tell that to? And you heard this, and it's like, you know, out of respect, so what did you do? You just came and you stuffed in the closet and you went back to work and the best you can. And because how do you think we've done with the whole post-combat related mental health thing? Both the active component and then after you get out.
I think we've tried, but you know, it's interesting, this resilience. I think that's what we missed. I don't think we put mechanisms in place to help people on the backside, but we really didn't do it on the front side. So I think that's a lesson learned for the future. So I think, and I love that term, resilience, is really preparing people for that. I think we did a little bit. I think we've done okay. I've seen some things. We still have problems with, you know, 22 suicides a day. We're just losing a lot of people, and a lot of it's tied to this. But I did see in the Marine Corps, there's something that, I don't know if it's Neller's initiative, where they're having targeted reunions of units that were in very, very heavy combat at specific times, and finding those Marines that were in those specific units and having reunions just so that they can see each other and they can find out who's in trouble. And I thought that was interesting. That's an interesting concept because they all go their separate way, and there's a certain, you know, you've been in country, when you're in that environment, there's a certain camaraderie that happens in combat in that environment that you will never, ever have again. And I think that's part of what they're missing, and that's part of which brings on depression and other things. So I think we're doing okay, but I think we could have done some other things better. We just got to stay on it.
My guest this morning is Mike Pesnola, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, currently the Executive Director at the Institute for Global Leadership at Tufts University. Hey, Pez, I got to take about a 2 or 3 minute break, and then we'll come back, and I want to talk about what you're doing now. I want to talk about your combat deployments and your migration to the Special Forces community. and talk about all that stuff as well. So give me a chance to take a quick break. More of Mike Pesnola, goalie from Massachusetts. The other thing he didn't tell you about Kelly is he's a Massachusetts guy, okay? All right.
Absolutely.
Pez kept it on the down low, but they know the secret handshake. All right, they're Massachusetts guys, and oh my God, the worst thing in the world was when the Red Sox won. Oh my God, it was awful. It was unbearable.
Oh,
I was in
freaking awesome.
I was in Ramadi with Sergeant Major Bell, who's from Boston. Dunford's from Boston. Thank God Kelly had left.
Oh man,
I know Kelly. I had a baseball on my desk. Kelly would grab it, and Kelly made me the staff sec for Mattis when Mattis's aide got wounded, and they made the staff sec the aide. And so Kelly comes to me and goes, I want you to be the staff sec. And I've been on the Marine Corps for 10 years. I said, I don't even know what that is, but it sounds gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but Kelly says, it is gay, but you're going to work for me and Joe Dunford, and you'll work for the CG. And I said, who's Joe Dunford? He goes, oh, he's a boss, and you'll love him. Okay, so Kelly would come get... Exactly. Kelly would come get this ball off my desk, you know, when he had nothing to do, which wasn't often, but, and he'd take it, and we're in this palace in Ramadi, and he'd throw it up, and he'd do the narrative. Kelly goes back. He jumps against the green monster. Oh, what a great catch. Kelly, the Red Sox win the World Series. Kelly saves the effing game. Unbelievable. And the Marines would be sitting there going, what the hell is going on?
What is he doing?
Right. And then he'd like do this little victory trot with the ball in the air. And I'm like, yeah. Combat gets to some people in different ways, but.
Yeah.
The whole Massachusetts thing is just unbearable. Anyway, we'll come back more with Mike Pesnola next on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good, but are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Henry Sergeant Gnarly Ermey here with important information for veterans. At 2,600 American job centers nationwide, veteran and transitioning military personnel can find help with career counseling, resumes, and job placement. You want more information, don't you? The Department of Labor offers a variety of programs to help our military heroes find good jobs or continue their education. What are you waiting for?
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom. For displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you. And we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
America, let me tell you about Sergeant Greg Anderson. Served two tours in Afghanistan, Bronze Star and Purple Heart recipient, and unemployed. The unemployment rate among transitioning service members is unacceptably high, much higher than the general population. Veterans are a proven commodity. They're mature, reliable, and hardworking. They deserve a chance to get back to work after serving their country. Do you really want to honor a veteran? Hire one. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Minutes after 9 o'clock here on a Wednesday morning. Mike McNamara with you. Hump Day. Democratic conventions continue. So nothing but news out of there. We continue our discussion with Mike Pesnola, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, and currently the Executive Director at the Institute for Global Leadership at Tufts University. Pez, I want to talk to you about your migration to the Special Forces community. How did that happen?
Interesting. For those who don't know, the MARSOC experiment was somewhat of a shotgun wedding when Rumsfeld told the Commandant at the time, hey, you're going to become part of the Special Operations community, because the Special Operations community was overstretched, and it had commitments around the globe that it just couldn't meet. So MARSOC was born, and I was selected as the first commander of the 06 command there, which was name changed a number of times from Foreign Military Training Unit to Marine Special Operations Advisor Group, and then eventually now it's the regiment. It's the Special Operations Regiment. So I was brought on board pretty early in the process. So it was a fascinating time as we were putting together MARSOC. We had obviously the force recon migration, which brought some skill sets, which were tremendous, but General Halleck at the time was brought in other people as well, because he saw that we needed new blood, new ideas. We needed people that needed to learn what special operations is, because it's more than just special reconnaissance or direct action. So it was fascinating time. We our focus was on foreign internal defense. It was which is going to our partner nations around the world and building relationships, building trust, building skill sets so that we can hopefully prevent the next Afghanistan or Iraq. So learning language was a key part of that. So, and I stood up also a schoolhouse as part of that. And again, it was a great time. We had to be humble because we were the new guys on the block. A lot of doors got shut in our face because the Special Operations community, many didn't see the need, but we were here. So, we humbly went to USASOC, to the Army Special Operations, Naval Special Warfare, even Air Force Special Operations, to just learn. And within a year, we had teams deployed to South America, to the Stands, to Africa, and doing great work, and mostly foreign terrain defense. And then we were brought into Afghanistan. So it was a tremendous time. But it was hard. Yeah. It was probably the hardest thing was balancing the hard skills and the soft skills, because you could spend, if you had 100 hours, you could spend 100 hours on your shoot, move, communicate hard skills.
Right.
And you'd never be satisfied. But you got to spend time in a language lab learning a language, because to this day, I think we made a big mistake, even in the countries we went to, in Afghanistan and Iraq, not speaking the language, because when you're speaking through a translator, trust can only be built so far.
Right.
You have trust translator, but not the person you're talking to.
Right. Talk to me. Give me lessons learned from Iraq and Afghanistan. Dave Furness and I were talking a little bit, and I'm curious about your opinion. Secretary Rumsfeld's strategy of, you know, smaller force on the ground with special forces kind of, you know, doing their thing at night, you know, whacking, you know, targets and doing what they do, was not a recipe for success in Iraq. Do you have, you know, thoughts on it? And again, I'll give you mine, is I thought General Shinseki was right. and you needed to go bigger to be able to sit on it so we didn't have to play whack-a-mole, which would allow our special forces really to get after, you know, those high-value targets that they should be pursuing. What happened was we played whack-a-mole, so we could never really get the lid on that thing the way it needed its lid to be on, which then I think activated more, you know, special forces targets because we couldn't control it. And but I'm curious from the special forces perspective, your thoughts on the way Iraq happened, 2004 through, you know, 2010.
No, I think now I have to preface this. My tours were with special operations in Afghanistan,
okay.
not in Iraq. But I can tell you, you know, it's very, very similar. You know, I use the analogy that, you know, we had an industrial strength, you know, weed eater, but we had bargain basement seed, grass seed. We could kill. We got very good at target, you know, at the the find, fix, finish cycle at killing terrorists. But you can't kill your way to victory. You have to be on the ground. You have to be building relationships. You have to appreciate what's happening and develop the security, the Iraqi or Afghani security forces so that they're built, they have trust with the population. If you're not there, you're not going to do it. So I'm with you. I think we have a world class killing outfit, which you need. That's part of the piece, but we do not invest heavily enough. And I go back to my point about language, about cultural appreciation, about being there. So that's one piece. And then the other piece is while we say we don't try to build the Iraqi forces or the Afghan forces in our image, we do.
Right.
When you go, especially the high-end special operations forces, they're very good, but they're Western. I always felt that I would be more comfortable if we provided them capabilities, but in their own way. They don't need a Western military. They need security. They need to out-Taliban the Taliban in terms of, you know, be better than the Taliban from a fighting perspective, but be better than the Taliban in terms of taking care of the people.
Right.
I'm not sure that we do that. We have we import a Western way on them. And I think that's a recipe for disaster. Unless you're going to be there for 50 years, like we were in Korea and Japan and Germany. You know, what would have happened to those if we left in 1960? I don't think there'd be the Korea, Germany. You know, we wouldn't be driving Hyundais, you know. So I think unless you're committed, they got to do it on their own terms. That's just my thought, I think. Got to be there. Got to plant the seeds.
Well, you've tickled a nerve that we talk about here on All Marine Radio, and that is if you pull a string from Vietnam through Somalia, through Lebanon to Somalia to Iraq and Afghanistan, we're pretty good at the killing part of this. But, you know, Pez, one of the things that you and I both learned at the foot of John Kelly was war is politics by other means. You go to war to win the peace. You go to war to win phase four. And we are horrible at phase four. And, you know, Dave Furness just talked about, you know, the situation we find ourselves in Iraq is we, you know, our vested interest is on the side of Saudi Arabia. Okay. The largest military, right? The Iranians are the most aggressive and the largest military. And now they've seeped into the wood of Iraq. Which means they're right next door to Syria and the Persian Empire, which, you know, is Iran. That's how that whole region was theirs, and that's how they see it. And so when you're looking for a solution to this, you're like, you know, God, we're just, it's almost like we're amateurs in this. Did somebody actually believe in the OPT, the planned Iraq? Okay. We're going to offload in Kuwait, get everybody online, we're going to go, we're going to whack them, we'll install another government, and then we're going to leave. That's going to work. Everybody good?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was nobody in there that put their hand up and said, hey, what happens if it doesn't go like that? What happens if we have to stay longer? And it's like, and I'm with you, Pez. If it's that important to our strategic interests and the president says, hey, we're going to go and we're going to be there for 30 years. We're going to be there in a big way for probably about four because we're going to have 200 to 300,000 soldiers and Marines there. And we're going to sit on that place, but it's in our strategic interest to do this. And I, as your president, believe in it. We're going to do this. Congress has got to approve it. This is the way we go to war. And we're going to be there for 30 to 50 years in some way, shape, or form. And we're, but at the end of it, we're going to have a stable peace like we have in Germany, like we have in Japan, like we have in South Korea. We're going to have another peace like that in this region. It's vital to our security. We're going. Like, you know what? Okay, I got it. I can, I'll sign up for that. But it's almost like we try to engineer this hybrid nonsense, and then we want to leave early before phase four is complete. And it's like, why 7,000 of our peers, the most beautiful and courageous things on the planet, if you could watch them in combat, are dead? Like, why? How do you morally ask the American people to do that and then walk away from it? And so what you said, I'm completely sympathetic to, and it's so frustrating to watch this stuff and think, holy smokes, where are we going with military force in this country? We don't seem to know how to wield it responsibly.
No, I'm with you. And it's also, where are the marshals? Where are today's marshals? Where are the diplomats? Where are the strategists? And I'm talking outside the military that are advising the president. They're not present. They're not there. They're not thinking this through. And, like what happened with Rumsfeld, where was the strong, moral, well-educated, in history, person that could stand up and say, wait a minute, let's think this through. This isn't going to be easy. And there are a lot of larger, second and third order effects that we need to think through if we're going to go in here. And we need to figure phase four. We need to figure out what's the end state. What do we want at the end of Iraq? What do we want at the end of Afghanistan? And it's not going to come cheap. You're not going to fix Afghanistan in a decade. It's never going to be Switzerland, but could it go the road of Colombia? Maybe, where you have a functioning state, decentralized, but you don't have a breeding ground for terrorists.
Right.
So I think it's all tied together. But where are today's great statesmen? I don't see them. I don't see them. Anyway.
Well, you know what? Two thoughts on that, Pez. The thing in Afghanistan, the broadening of the ground war, that OPT, if you read 20 minutes of Afghan history, you'll know that what we're trying to create had never been created in the history of the country.
No. The future of Afghanistan should be a decentralized state. You are going to have, they call them warlords, just the regional, power brokers. And that's what you're going to have. And what we need is those regional power brokers need to provide security for the people. Like I say, out Taliban the Taliban, and provide security for the people and prevent bad things from happening, but in a very decentralized way. May not be perfect for us. It's not going to be. It may not even be called democracy, but we don't want what happened before to happen there. And we don't want a breeding ground for terrorists that want to come kill us. So how do you do that? You make friends with them. You provide them enough capability, but on their terms, and you make sure that they remain our allies, our friends that won't allow these bad things to happen.
Somewhere Robert Humphreys is smiling, Pez.
Yeah.
Here's an email. Mac, I keep hearing Robert Humphreys' name. Could you give us the title of his book? Because what's the book that they can buy? What's the title?
I believe it's Values into the Next Millennium.
Okay.
If you look for that by Robert Humphreys into the Next Millennium, it has a subtitle. Bob will probably share it.
Okay. Values into for a new millennium? Values into
for a new millennium. Yeah, I think for a new millennium. Yeah,
okay. All right.
It was written right around the. Yeah.
But what Pez is talking about is exactly the things that are espoused in the book. Talk to me about General. And I want to ask you this question, and I want to talk about what you're doing at Tufts. General Allen's going to speak at the Democratic Convention, obviously endorsing Hillary Clinton. First question, what are your thoughts on generals speaking out like that? So that's the first question. Good thing, bad thing?
Well, I think retired generals, I don't see it as a problem, because I think they have a level of experience, especially someone like Allen, what he's seen and what he can provide, I think is value to whomever it is, either side. I know you have Mike Flynn working with the other side. So right. They've seen things, done things, and I think that's okay. As long as the uniform's off, that's fine. But there is a danger there because, there is a danger in terms of separation between the military and politics and so forth. But again, Allen's a civilian, right? He worked for the administration. So.
All right, let's talk about what you're doing at Tufts. First of all, when did you retire from the Marine Corps?
Retired aboard the Constitution in September 2000 or October 2014, and started here at the same time. Interesting place called the Institute for Global Leadership, undergraduate program, but we also work closely with Fletcher. And it's really it's a fascinating place. It's an experiential education focused institute that builds global ethical leaders. And the way we do it is we have three courses and support a number of student programs. But our flagship program is called EPIC, Education for Public Inquiry and International Citizenship. We take a conundrum issue every year. We've done religion, politics, and society in the past. We've done global poverty. We've done future democracy. Last year, we did Europe in turmoil. We just take a subject. And the unique thing with the course is, year-long course, is we put the students in the driver's seat. We don't have a soup-to-nuts syllabus to start the year. We have a few weeks where we bring guest lecturers in. And then, interestingly, we bring them to Outward Bound up in New Hampshire. And Outward Bound's a fascinating team-building experience. So we do that to build the students. The course has anywhere from 20 to 30, 40 kids, students. It builds them as a team. We have some speakers speak. Like last year, we had some experts on Europe speak. But also, it allows us to learn them and find out from them, why did you sign up for this course, Europe in Turmoil, EPIC, Europe in Turmoil? And we found that they were interested in human trafficking, migration, security. So from that learning from the students, we craft the rest of the syllabus for the rest of the year.
Wow.
So that's their piece in it. But also, more importantly, in February, we have a very large symposium with upwards of 250 speakers. And normally, world-class academics, practitioners, experts in the field. We had the former chief of staff of the British military, General Richards, here last year. And we don't go out and get them. The students do it. So the students build this symposium of everything from a culture night to workshops to panels. They build the panels based on their interests and desires, and then they populate them. They get on the phone with these policymakers, these practitioners all over the world, and they come here. And we also have an international piece where we bring about 80 students from around the world, from universities that we're in contact with, and they all come here to participate as well. So it's fascinating. That's EPIC. It's a fascinating course. And then we have a program for narrative and documented practice, which looks like a journalism course, but it's designed to give future policymakers, business people, graduates that go into government, give them storytelling capability so that they can better communicate an idea with everything from video to photography to writing. It's run by Gary Knight, world-famous photojournalist. He runs that. And then the third course we have is Inquiry, which is just a high school program where we bring about 300 300 high school students here for about 4 or 5 days. And our students, our EPIC students, become the teachers. It's on the same subject. Like last year was on Europe. And it's more structured in terms of a scenario. They go through that, and they have delegates. They have, you know, they represent different countries, different functions, economics, defense, and so forth. So those are the three courses we run. And then every year, the students are so energized, they really start student groups. We have one called Allies, which is a CivMil group, which is a consortium with us, the Naval Academy of West Point, and they tackle CivMil issues. These are kids that aren't going to go in the military, but just are interested with that. And they all get together periodically. And the idea is, if you can, and I've seen it, you can build the relationship between this Tufts graduate that's not going to have a uniform on, that's going to be going to business, going to nonprofit, going to government. As an undergraduate, you build personal relationships with these Naval Academy, West Point students that will go into the military. You know, who knows in 10 years, 20 years, right, that these relationships be better. You know, that's just one group. But we've got an international development group for one focused on India, one focused on Latin America, entrepreneurship group called Empower, New Initiative for Middle East Peace. So all these student groups, again, it's all part of the experiential learning. They're running this group. They're doing this thing. They're bringing in guest speakers. So it's fascinating, you know, that these things all go on. And then we support research internships. We have about 60 students out right now around the world. We support them with stuff. But it's all this, it's this, what I call an academic interdisciplinary ecosystem that's all interconnected. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating place to be.
So now, Mike, is that all stuff that's offered to undergraduates at Tufts, or are these seminars where people are coming in throughout the course of the year?
The courses, EPIC's a year-long course, and it's offered to the undergraduates, and it's purposely not tied to a major, because we don't want students coming here to check a block. It's a really hard course. It's a very difficult course to get through. But students line up because they know that it's challenging and they know they get a lot out of it. And that's a year-long course. The PNDP, the storytelling one, is just a semester-long course. And then inquiries focused on the students, on the high school students. All the student groups, those are voluntary. They do that on their own time. Like Allies, they have a guest speaker every week, or they have something every week. They're student groups that they run. That's pretty much how it runs.
Mike Pesnola, our guest here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, and Pez's been gracious enough to give us his time this morning. He's currently the executive director of the Institute for Global Leadership. That's what we're talking about at Tufts University. And Mike, does this open doors to you relative to developing new programs? It sounds like a great place to really implement and study leadership as it's practiced throughout the world in a variety of different ways. Does it give you also the chance to be creative and developing new programs?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And well, like with the EPIC program, that changes every year. We select a different conundrum issue, a global issue that we tackle. So every year we do something a little bit different. And then, there are, you know, opportunities to kind of expand. It's just that it's this incubator for innovative ideas. So yeah, things happen all the time out of here.
Mike, give me the most exciting thing that you guys are working on in the future.
In the future, well, we're at the last. We have not selected the subject for next year, but so I can't talk about that. But the exciting things that we're doing for the future, right now we're getting ready to launch about 6 of our students, PNDP, the Program Narrative and Documentary Practice students, to go to Rajasthan, India, to link up with Indian students to do a storytelling photographic essay on issues happening in Rajasthan, part of India. They're actually getting on the airplane in 2 days. So that's what's happening now. But that's just one of the many things that we do during the summer to support the students.
All right. Now let's talk college hockey. We did all the rest of this interview just to come to this, okay? Just so everybody knows.
Yeah.
The University of North Dakota, currently the reigning Division I college hockey championships. College hockey has exploded as a sport. Changes that were made years ago by USA Hockey relative to the USHL and the way junior hockey gets played in the country, I think have made a huge difference in terms of becoming not a competitor but a pipeline into Division I college hockey. Talk to us about the explosion of the sport. You played it, and you know, it used to be kind of a boutique sport, and now you see it on ESPN. You see it on the different regional sports channels, exploding across the country. Played in the South now, University of Alabama Huntsville, University of Arizona. You know, all have teams. Talk about the explosion of college hockey. You must be obviously as a player and as a fan, you must be pleased as a punch to see the way it's growing.
Oh, it is. It's fascinating. You know, obviously, you know, I'm a fan of the Big East teams. I'm a Lowell fan, but you know, between the East and the Midwest, and that, like you said, it's going all over the place. So it is fascinating, and I think it's good for the sport. And we haven't even talked about the women's hockey side of that, which is growing, you know, tremendously. My niece plays high school hockey, and it's amazing how much that side of the sport has grown. But absolutely, and the coverage you're getting on, shit, I think it was on regular ESPN. You know, I know the championships when we watched that.
Right.
So it's fascinating, and you know, and the opportunities for the players are just, I mean, out of this world. I mean, they are awesome. So it's great. You know,
a good friend of mine. He has twin daughters, and they both play on the women's national team, Monique and Jocelyn Lamoureux. And
wow,
you know who they are, right?
Yeah,
they.
Wow.
You should, first of all,
know you were friends with them.
Oh yeah, no, they're great. It's a great hockey family, and my youngest, my two sons played with two of Pierre's sons, but well, my youngest son played with the those two girls. And so we would go all over North Dakota, Minnesota with these two girls, and we would beat the shit out of everybody. And then when it got into Pee Wee hockey, when they could check, you know, you heard, oh, they're going to get theirs now. They laid the wood, the guys, all over the region. And they're tough girls. They're great girls. But the opportunities that they've had afforded to them to travel the world. I used to have them on my radio program all the time, and you know, going, whether it be the opportunities that come with being an Olympic athlete, the education they get in terms of the places they visit, you know, the way they reach out and touch people that are disadvantaged or people in hospitals and all the things they do, it's an incredible experience. And as you said, Mike, the opportunities for women exploding. And college hockey is one of the big providers of that experience, at least a new way with Title IX across the country. And you know, colleges have to provide those experiences. And
absolutely.
Monique and Jocelyn, man, they've really benefited from it.
You know what else has changed is when you look at the rosters. I saw that when I went to the championships this year. When I was in, half of your roster or more, like at Lowell, were Canadians. And now, I mean, there's Canadians that come down here to play, but you see predominance just American players that are you know, are up playing on that highest level. So that's the change that I've seen over.
Pez, is there anything better than when you're hanging out with your Canadian friends and you look at them and you say, you know, it's our sport now. They just
absolutely.
Oh, hey, Pez, how does that go over when you say that? You know it's ours now.
Oh, man. Yeah. Hey, that's all they got. What does Canada have, man?
Nothing. Nothing. They got some oil in Alberta. That's it. Otherwise, they got nothing.
Yeah. They got hockey, you know. And this year, what was it? The playoffs had no Canadian teams.
And the number one kid in the NHL draft was from Arizona.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Turned upside down.
Yeah, I'm sorry, boys. It's over for you. You're yesterday's
it's over,
dude.
It's over. All right. Yeah, you got to find another sport.
All right, Pez, first of all, how many, your family, obviously married to a blind date. What the hell?
Yeah.
That's awesome. How many kids?
Yeah. I have four kids. Mike's, he's, works at a startup film production company down in Fredericksburg. He went to doing the School of Broadcasting up here. But he has a band, Beyond the Aftermath. They did a huge tour. They did a 20-city tour, actually played in Austin, Texas back a few months ago. They have a band. The band has a band. They just traveled around. So that's my oldest. Then Ava's in college down in Virginia. And then my son is graduated, Anthony. He's going to go in the Marine Corps. He wants to basically get into the FBI or something like that. So he's going to go into the Marine Corps as an infantry guy and then go to school. That's the plan right now. And then Dominic, my youngest, is going to be a junior in high school. Four of them.
Wow. I like that.
None of them hockey players.
What?
None of them. Moving around so much. Soccer, man.
Oh, my God.
It's the next best thing.
I can't. It's really not. We both know it, but I respect the fact that you actually go to war with it.
Yeah.
The way they roll around,
your
kids never rolled around on the ground, did they?
Oh, hey, no. Quick story. My youngest son, very, very, very good soccer player at 11. He played on a German team. Only American that started. And I think they were. It was summertime, so they were playing up. So they were 11-year-olds, but playing against 12-year-olds. These are all German kids.
Right.
And he's a tough kid, and he gets knocked down, and then he pops right back up. The coach, which is a Turkish guy, a hockey, pulled him aside and he said, "Listen, here's what you do: you go down, you rub your eyes, and you start crying, and you do not get up. Do you understand?" And I thought it was weird because we would, when we first started playing, like every game, like two or three times, a kid would be carried off the field, bawling, crying. But they teach him early. I don't know.
What did Dominic say? I can't. I cannot do that.
If I do that,
my dad will come on the field.
He couldn't do it. He's like, he'd bounce up like a. Oh yeah, but it was fun. It was fun. My daughter played on the German team. It was fun.
What were you doing in Germany?
I was the assistant chief of staff for UCOM, so I was kind of the bull colonel to run the headquarters there in Stuttgart. Great tour, great time, and met a lot of great people. Worked for Adam Servetus, who's now the director of Fletcher School here at Tufts University.
Wow. Well, there you go, right?
Great tour. All comes together.
I have four kids, and both my boys are
two infantry officers. Man, congratulations on that.
Well, I didn't have a whole lot to do with it. You know what? They were you and Pace, you'll get this. My sons were tremendously influenced by my friends, right?
Yeah.
And Pez knows, because Pez is one of them. We haven't seen each other in years, but smart guys, funny as hell. Okay.
Yeah.
We talk about what a great tour it was that we all had at the basic school at that time. Dave Furness was there, Pez was there, I was there, General Kelly, General Allen, General Craparata, General Osterman, General Milstead, General Amos, all these, General Kennedy.
Absolutely.
All these guys are there. And so, but I have never laughed that much in my life, in one tour. I mean, we had the best time. And Pez was truth be told, Pez was pretty deadly with a hockey stick. All right, and when you were supposed to be in the D and you were screwing it up, more than one lieutenant got cross checked when they were doing the wrong thing in the middle of something stupid going on.
I have a baseball bat in my office right now. And it is signed by my first platoon that I was the SBC for, and that's why they gave me the baseball bat.
No, let me tell you, We used to have, you know, so much fun. And, you know, one of the things that we did was we loved to teach lieutenants. You know, there's some guys who don't, but the group of guys that we were with, I mean, we loved lieutenants, and we'd bust their balls, and we'd push them hard. And as Mike was saying, you know, you had guys like, you know, Bill Lynn rolling around, and this whole maneuver warfare thing was coming into the Marine Corps, and they would say stuff like, it's got to be completely free play. Now, we're going out to do it, and we've taught all this stuff. Like, oh, well, if we don't make contact, then what do we practice? So how does it become completely free play? Because they'll, you know, what happens if they're screwing up the navigation and they're not going to hit the defense? Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
After a month's worth of work in movement to contact, that they don't hit the defense? And so, you know, and then it was like, well, the Germans, you know, all this initiative. It's like, okay, well, everybody can't have their own dance card. And I told the story of going up to the National Archives and getting Albert Wiedemeyer translated the German troop leading manual and then bring it back down to IOC and killing the copy machine by, you know, making 50 copies of it and handing it out to Pez and Paul Schreiber and, you know, and all the great guys that that we had there. And then us going through that, what did the squad leader learn in the German army? And then you find this paragraph that says, if by the use of your initiative, you fritter away the combat power of the commander, you will do so at the peril of your own. And I can't remember what it said. And you read that and you're like, oh, yeah, that's how they did it. And then this whole German concept of, and we might have coined the term, but coordinated initiative. Your initiative on your own is bullshit. And especially, you know, all you have to do is stop it. You know, the uncoordinated flanking attack at the basic school as soon as you make contact by saying, hey, look, I don't know where it is, but there, I put one live round in somebody's blanks. So, hey, good luck. And then all of a sudden, you know, the flanking attack, no, I'm not going anywhere.
I'm not doing that.
And so, you know, we were trying to learn the lessons of how do you teach it. And it was, but we had an awful lot of fun doing it, man. And, but Pez was a legend with his hockey stick. Angry Italian with a hockey stick. Be careful.
Yeah. But my favorite time there, you know, and it was, I brought this up before, the Zen Patrol, you know, when I, you know, teaching patrolling was fun, but I, you know, again, it was part of that learning. Something was wrong. You know, we would give the students the books, which told them how to patrol. We'd go on the big sand table, we'd tell them how to patrol, and then they'd go out and patrol. And sometimes they did good, but they were very inward focused because they were trying to do what we told them to do.
Right.
And this was hard for me to do, and it never survived because people didn't have the good enough imagination. We threw away the books. We put them in the field. I don't know if you remember this. We put them in the field with no schooling. And we prior enlisted, we pulled aside and said, no, you don't say anything. And we basically said, figure it out. Here's your mission. You need to go from here to here. And you know what? They taught themselves that they knew more than they thought.
Right.
And the hard part was teaching the instructor not to take over and to ask good Socratic questions, go through the patrol. And then the value was on the sand table after action, then you start put together the pieces. So that's kind of like what I'm doing here, experiential. Put them in the experience so they're outward focused, not inward focused, on trying to do what Captain Pesnola or Captain McNamara told them to do. They haven't been told what to do, so they got to figure it out. So it opens some lights. But again, the powers that be, I think over time, saw that as an extravagance, and I saw it as central. It's central to what you're doing.
Well, you know, one of the different they would think. One of the differences, so I would tell you, Pez, I think, and again, I just say the names, pretty robust, not only intellect, but tough, you know, tough and funny guys. And I said, those are the guys that influenced my sons. In fact, one of my sons is an instructor at the basic school right now. And so, but one of the things that we were into as a group, we were into education. Like, we could go get up and teach, right? And, you know, we could go do ELO, stomp your foot, this is going to be on the test. But that wasn't good enough. And I remember talking about how you teach on a sand table and how we screw it up because, you know, the normal template is, okay, you go in, the guy gives you your little guide, you go to the sand table, You know, normally it's already set up for you. The lieutenants come in, you give them, you know, the situation, and you say, okay, you got 15 minutes, you know, go do your thing, come back. Then you bring the guy in, one of them's stupid enough to say, I'll do it. And then everybody does this. What if this? What if this? What if this? What if this? Well, that's not, so what do you, what's the end state? A lieutenant learns, and everybody else ought to, never to put his hand up again. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that, because mm-hmm. So what I would do is, what I evolved my two was, okay, I need two of you to stay, you're going to be the bad guys, and all the rest of you guys go out and do your thing. So the bad guys have a course of action. They're limited. Right. They're not everywhere. We're the Marine Corps, man. We have the best capital. We have great equipment, and nobody can stand up against us when we bring it on. If you're decisive and just keep unscrewing yourself. And so that was the lesson that in my mind I was teaching. Okay, so we're going to pick one guy. They're going to give the order. You can ask questions, but I don't want to hear what if. And I don't want to hear don't you think. You ask a question like you're a squad leader and you're going to execute this, okay? So come in. Who wants to do it?
Absolutely.
I do, sir. Give your order and say it like you mean it. Now, any questions about execution? No. Okay, now we're going to execute. So now guys were squad leaders. Okay, everybody could move somebody on the little sand table, you know, a couple inches, right? And I'd look at the bad guy. You guys ready to do anything? And they'd like shake their head. No. But what would happen is, and I had a coin in my pocket, and I had a tack war die, which was a 10-sided die, I think. And I'd say, okay, battlefield random luck's going to occur. Heads or tails, bud? You know, flip the coin. Heads. Oops. It's against you. That guy just snapped his leg in two places. What are you going to do? I got to call in a medevac. Okay, put your finger in your ear and call it in. And then you get the, that class was 2 weeks ago, sir. I don't remember. Shut up and call it in. Right? And so now they're running the medevac, and then the bad guys say, we want to shoot now. Okay, what's the probability that you'd shoot? You see them. Right, probability that you'd hit him at less than 600 meters in wooded terrain. I don't know, 50-50, sir. Okay, all right. Tack war dies. 1 to 5, you hit. Right, 5 to 8, you suppress, and otherwise it's a miss. 9, you missed, and they saw tracers. Now what? And then you go through this decision-making exercise where you don't have to be perfect. You just have to keep unscrewing yourself, and then whack him, and you'll beat him. And then the end state was, A, they enjoyed themselves. They found it intellectually interesting. They wanted to do it again because they won. They weren't the village idiot.
Right.
And so, say that because what Pez is talking about with what became known as the Zen Patrol was exactly that. It was learning, right? And I think in a little bit of a non-traditional Marine Corps way. But they learned more. They learned more from it, and they learned a lot more than just patrolling from it.
Right, and they're making, you know, and I don't think our schools have enough of this, is decision-making, and that's, decision-making, multiple opportunities to make decisions. Not, I think I'll do this. No, what's your decision? Give me the decision. Every day in our schools, that should be happening, and it doesn't. Our schools, I think, have a lot of transmission, but it needs to be that type of active learning on a daily basis that truly educates and trains the mind to be prepared for, you know, the rigors of combat. You know, we just I don't think we do that enough.
Well, and you know, to me, the thing that you learn is, as you teach like that, you don't have to give a perfect order. You don't have to
Absolutely.
Be perfect in execution, but you got to be decisive. You can't be afraid, and you got to throw that thunderous right hook that we can throw as a combined arms organization.
Right.
You know,
you
just
put it together.
Right. I just walked into machine guns crossing in front of me and mortars dropping in that little depression in front of me. That would mean there's a prepared defense in front of me. What do I do? Let me get my ass down, as General Zinni would say, plaster the bastards with fire. All right, let your FO and your FAC, let them have it, and then go have your way with them. Blast the shit out of them, because we're the Marine Corps, man. And I used to tell this to lieutenants. There's no better organization on the planet. All right, we have the best human capital. We have great equipment. We have our own Air Force, for God's sakes, okay? Even when you're screwed, you can win. Just don't stop throwing that hook. And if you know what I mean? But, Pez, you know how we do the sand table thing. That's not what they'd walk away with at the end. Like, oh man, I'm never put my hand up again. That was pretty miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's better.
If you're doing it like you say, you cycling, everyone's doing it.
Right.
Everyone's doing it, and
right.
They're enjoying it. And they're making decisions. It's going to be good decisions. It's going to be bad decisions. But they're decisions. You're going through the process. You're not just saying, well, mealy mouth, I might do this or I might do this. No.
And, I will tell you this. I think the work that we did, and I would say we were there during somewhat of an intellectual renaissance, I think, of the Marine Corps in terms of maneuver warfare and trying to figure it out. But, the way we operated both in Iraq and Afghanistan, out of firm bases, very decentralized, lieutenants and staff sergeants and sergeants, running these operations very far away from the battalion flag and the regimental flag and the division flag, that whole thing got set up by the study of maneuver warfare, by understanding commanders' intent and things like that. And there isn't a finer organization relative to human capital and leadership than the Marine Corps. And, Pez, your thoughts, incredible to watch the courage and the selflessness of those young guys every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that we pride ourselves, as a service, is we're about people. We're about those individuals and everything from the PFC up to the general. But it's instilling in them, those things like we talked about. And I think it has been a success story. The seeds were planted in 1989-90 with the maneuver warfare movement, if you will. And those lieutenants are now the generals. Some of them that are running the Corps. And those lieutenants influence the sergeants that are now sergeant majors, master gunnery sergeants. So I think it is seeped in, and it has created, that environment, which was so successful, I think, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, that you saw that allowed us to do what we did and to operate centralized the way we did.
All right. About four more questions, and I'll let you go. First of all, give me a favorite quote.
All right. Favorite quote. Well, I got one on my computer. Let me read it.
All right.
Can I read it to you?
Absolutely.
All right. This is John Boyd talking to a lieutenant. Tiger, one day you'll come to the fork in the road, and you're going to have to make a decision about which direction you want to go. If you go that way, you can be somebody. You will have to make compromises. You will have to turn your back on your friends, but you will be a member of the club. You get promoted. You get the good assignments, or you can go that way and you can do something for your country, something for your Air Force. If you decide you want to do something, you may not get promoted, you may not get the good assignments, and certainly you'll not be the favorite superiors, but you won't have to compromise yourself. You'll be true to yourself and to your friends, and your work might make a difference. To be somebody or to do something in life is often a roll call. That's when you'll make the decision to be or to do. Which way will you go to be or to do? So, John Boyd, my favorite quote's on my computer.
Author of The Concept of the OODA Loop. We had a chance to meet Colonel Boyd, and you also
absolutely.
You also used the phrase out Taliban the Taliban, which is David Hackworth, out G the G.
Out G the G, yeah. We had him.
We had a chance to meet him, too. The all right, favorite. Give me a favorite book to read.
Favorite book to read. Enlightened Soldier, Charles White, Scharnhorst. I mean, it's about the defeat of Jena and the defeat the Prussians made in Jena and how they changed their culture, their learning culture, how they changed. It became a very world, one of the best militaries in the world.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you a great book. I gave it to Ted Greeley, who taught at the basic school in IOC behind us. And then I took it back from him and gave it to my son, The Enlightened Soldier. It's an awesome, awesome, awesome book.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Again.
Favorite food?
Favorite food? I would say chicken parmesan.
Pez, I was going to say, if it isn't Italian, all right, some crevice in Massachusetts is going to swallow you up today. Favorite musical act?
split between Pink Floyd and Grateful Dead. Pick one.
You're a Grateful Dead guy?
Yeah.
Wow.
I got to think outside the box, man. Come on, man.
Well, hey, they are definitely outside the bun. I'm telling you that. All right. And, well, hey, Pez, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on and doing this morning. First of all, great to catch up with you. But, you know, what you're doing relative to leadership and then your thoughts on the Marine Corps and where it is relative to mental health and other things like that. Absolutely awesome stuff. And, hope you don't mind if the future, if I bug you again and bring you back on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Keep doing what you're doing. It's great stuff.
All right. No, we'll do a round table. I'll get Furness. I'll get you. We'll get somebody else.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And we'll rip each other a new ass.
Yeah, absolutely, man. No, that's great. I look forward to that.
All right, bud. Thank you again.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
You bet.
Have a good day.
You bet. That is Mike Pezzanola. Pez, awesome guy. And, again, as you've heard, I mean, you know, both guys this morning, it happened by chance, but, they're smart, funny, tough combat veterans and awesome guys. But, Mike Pezzanola, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, infantry guy, retired, currently the executive director at the Institute for Global Leadership at Tufts University. And, I'll tell you what, it's, Tufts, good on them. Got a good guy, good man. So we're going to take a quick break. Mike Musselman's going to join us on the Mike and Mike segment. More of All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, hump day, next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.